For a long time, of course, American conservatism has had at least an implicit class conflict as part of the narrative. You know, this idea of taxpayers, patriots, traditional culture, businessmen in many cases, consumers versus big government, you know, in many cases, foreigners, liberal culture, Hollywood, and so forth. With the Tea Parties, we've seen this class analysis made more explicit, especially in this very important work by Angelo Codevilla. It was first this article in the American Spectator on the ruling class versus the country class, and it was made into a book. I recommend everyone read the book. There's a lot of important insight in there, and it's very interesting. And it's about, you know, it's kind of a conservative with many libertarian leanings view of what's going on, about how there's the country class, the common Americans, middle America in many cases would be the cultural geographic proxy, versus the ruling class represented most by Democrats, but also by Republican politicians. And of course, big government is seen as the enemy, although there are interesting exceptions made, at least implicitly, concerning, say, the military, which becomes relevant. Meanwhile, in our society, the left has also had something of an implicit class analysis. They see it as, you know, at least some taxpayers in some cases, Americans, citizens, consumers, small businessmen, the poor, minorities, as versus big business, some politicians, more traditional institutions of hierarchy, and so forth. And this has also become more explicit with this movement, the Occupy Wall Street movement, which I'm sure you all know the basics of, so I won't waste time with that. The whole idea of 99% against the top 1% is clearly about class conflict. Though, you know, it raises questions. Who are the 99%? Who are the 1%? It can't be purely in terms of wealth, because here we see these police are messing with these occupiers, and the police probably aren't in the top 1% in terms of wealth. And it can't be purely in terms of wealth because so many fans of Occupy and so many people that most occupiers probably see as comrades are in the top 1% economically themselves. There's a group, the top 1% for the 99%, which underscores this interesting paradox. And then, of course, what about this guy? I mean, he says he's all for the 99% movement, at least now he does, and a good number of occupiers, though not all of them, maybe not even most of them, but a good number of them not only kind of like him, but some of them probably think that much of what their activism is about is defending elements of his agenda against conservatives out of power. I mean, this guy, not only is he the head of state, which puts him, I would think, in the top 1% in some sense, but he's not a particularly egalitarian one either in terms of who his big supporters are. We see these contradictions in the Occupy movement. There was an informal poll in October which underscored this a little, where about half of the occupiers polled. It's a small poll. It's not scientific, but about half of them said they'd reelect Obama. Surely three-fourths of them supported tax increases and things like that, which are governmental, but which they could say is still consistent with their idea of class analysis. But on the other hand, almost half of them thought the bailouts were necessary, which is kind of an interesting point. Not to be outdone, the Tea Party types are not devoid of contradictions themselves. One poll that was more extensive, I should say, than the last poll, found 70% of them were opposed to cuts in Medicare or Social Security to balance the budget. These are the largest elements of the entitlement state, the largest elements of the state, the federal government, other than the military, which they're not really that much into cutting either. In many of these states, though, I don't want to get into too many specifics, many of these state elections, Tea Party types are less likely to support Ron Paul than people who hate the Tea Parties. A couple of polls over a period of a year said that they like guys like Newt Gingrich. It's hard to get more establishment than that, you know, and then, you know, 57% like George W. Bush. I don't think even George W. Bush likes George W. Bush at this point. And they tend to favor war. Codevilla argues that the country class likes the military, but they think, you know, we can't have these endless wars and nation building. I think that's just wishful thinking, because the polls still show that self-described Tea Party types are more against cutting and running than, say, the Obama voters, because you can't just go into Afghanistan and leave a mere 11 years later. That would be irresponsible. Now, of course, there's some overlap, which is interesting because these groups don't tend to like each other, even though I stole this too. I don't believe in IP. They overlap in theoretically resenting the bailouts, even if they disagree on what to do about it. This guy, David Graeber, was one of the key planners early on in Occupy Wall Street. And though I don't agree with his economics, to his credit, he at least doesn't like the state. He doesn't think the answer is, you know, more government demanding national health care, stuff like that even. He argues that the history of inequality and social oppression couldn't have existed if it weren't for the state, armies, prisons, and police. And interestingly, Codavia makes the same point, more or less, in his book, Whatever Else Government May Be, It Is Inherently a Factory of Privilege and Inequality. And yet these two people on the two opposite sides of the spectrum are seen as opposites. And even though one side says they claim to stand for 99%, the other say they claim to stand for the great majority, well, if everyone hates the system, then why do we still have it, you know? Well, I agree with the occupiers and many of the Tea Partiers, in fact, that the corporate state is real, that the average American is in many cases being shafted for big businesses in league with the state. This is certainly true with the finance and certainly the military-industrial complex, as Rothbard's great book with a new introduction by Anthony Gregory, which I recommend you all read, is as he has demonstrated better than almost any new leftist, you know. And I think part of the confusion comes in the fact that the class analysis is there on left and right, but they get it wrong. Marx was right that ideas shape institutions, that oppression, however defined, requires some sort of ideological superstructure. And he was right that, you know, all history involves class struggles, and at its best, he identified the state itself as the oppressor. He had some great things to say about the state, but then on the other hand, he thought the state was simply the tool of the capitalists. I think he wasn't always consistent. At one point, he says, "No credit is due to me," which I just love taking out of context. But there's a context. He's saying no credit's due to me for the basics of class theory. He says it goes back to bourgeois economists and scholars. And in fact, in the classical liberal tradition, we have a class analysis. Jean-Baptiste Say, who loved commerce, nevertheless thought nothing was worse than merchants using the state to gain privilege at the expense of the little guy. One of his followers, Blanqui, as Ralph Rako mentions in his very important work on class analysis, Rako calls this probably the first economic history, or the first history of economic thought, rather, that there's always been class conflict. And this is 1837. And of course, in England, the Manchester School, Cobden and Bright, one of the three or four victories of liberalism in the last millennium, when we got something repealed that was important. John Bright termed this in terms of classes. War of classes was the corn law struggle. Classical liberals from Bastiat, who saw the state as creating a plundering class and victims of plunder. John Calhoun, who saw things in terms of tax eaters and taxpayers. William Leggett, the American poet, who in the 1830s not only identified something akin to class struggle, but said, "If you doubt, we have classes in America." And he was a classical liberal. His view was we need a separation of economics and state. He said, "If you deny we have classes like they do in feudalism, just go to Wall Street," he said 180 years ago. And this goes back to the fact that, you know, long ago, liberalism was against the state, which, as Rothbard identified in the 60s, was something that we could call conservative. And over time, the class struggle or class analysis became kind of like screwed up and turned into progressivism in some countries, and even worse, communism, state communism, and others, nothing worse than that. The corruption of Western liberalism, I think, dovetails with the corruption of class analysis, the confusion of the state as the tool of economic oppression, and maybe we can capture the state and use it against the plutocracy, which is the stupidest idea ever. And then in rebellion against this kind of warped liberalism, we had American conservatism, which explains their class analysis, which is kind of like a mirror image, and it's also messed up. The relevance of this isn't exactly clear to me, but I like this picture because it's just very, it's very, I mean, it's real. This is how they did it before Hitler in America. Of course, Rothbard is the anatomy of the state. He gets it right like usual. You all know that. But Hoppe, speaking of taking things out of context, Hoppe says Marx is essentially correct. That's socialist. But of course, what he says in his great piece on economic exploitation is Marx's argument about the state as the tool of economic privileged elite to steal from the rest of us, including workers and so forth, is legitimate. It's just that his whole concept of production and profit is so messed up because the labor theory of value doesn't understand time preference. So Hoppe identifies a confusion in economics being the core confusion with Marxism. So we could say, of course, the real answer for the Tea Parties and the occupiers is just to focus on what's good, the market, defend that against the state. But class analysis of our own kind, I think, needs some refining, or at least we need to keep talking about it, because I don't think I think that there are kind of problems raised or some things to consider. One, this might seem like I'm strawmanning, but I think it raises an issue that's simple enough at first, but it brings up other issues. I mean, who's the ruling class? I guess there's a distinction to be made between the ruling class, who actually makes decisions and controls everything, and then the parasitic class, which is more implied by Calhoun's idea of tax eaters. But, you know, some people have argued that, you know, those on welfare are somehow the enemy, because they're net tax consumers. Well, I don't think this is the best way to determine who's good and who's bad. Bill Kristol, I'm sure, is a net taxpayer. He makes his money in the private sector calling for mass murder. That's his job. He writes articles saying, let's go murder more people. And he doesn't commit aggression making his money, but I think he's more part of the ruling class, or at least more of a bad guy. And then the one confusion comes in seeing the middle class. It's very tempting to see it as the middle class are the victims. The super rich, we don't like them anyway, because they got even us libertarians want more money, and they got all the money, and they're probably stealing from us. And then the poor people, well, they're not working. But the middle class, we're the victims, except as this Tea Party slogan, keep government out of my Medicare, underscores, not really. I mean, so much of the entitlement state is at least pays toward the middle class, Medicare, Social Security, public education, unemployment insurance. Most of welfare perhaps goes to the middle class. Now, there's this really crazy scholar, Walter Block, I think, who's come up. He's come up in his piece on punishment for statism, the crime of statism. He talks about class analysis, and he makes a very controversial point that politicians and the Fed chief are bad guys, which thanks for that. But he also argues that private criminals are part of the ruling class, which I think would raise an interesting question, because I don't think they're part of the ruling class. I think they're obviously predatory. If they're part of the ruling class, I think police certainly would be, because they commit aggression almost as a matter of course, enforcing unjust laws. And then there are other questions. Are teachers part of the victim class, the ruling class? How much of what government officials whose jobs are not purely non-coercive, but somewhere in the middle, like what's going on? This left libertarian, Kevin Carson, says that public teachers would basically be the same in a free market. So, but I have my doubts. Maybe I'm more leftward on children. And then this Roderick Lang guy, or Long, sorry, he explains how on economics, you know, a lot of confusion comes from left to right, depending on who we blame most, the state or the plutocracy. And he comes up with five possibilities. And of course, he doesn't even pick one of them. He picks one in the middle of two and three. I think that the very notion of deciding who would be better off or worse off in the free market is kind of difficult to know because we don't know what the free market would look like. So it's not a rigorous point, but it's almost like a calculation problem. Some people are obviously bad. These guys are probably bad. I don't like him. That guy's being a jerk. I think that we should go with what Lou Rockwell says, the enemy's always the state. And one important point is there's no proxy for liberty. The whole attempt at class analysis shouldn't be turned into like a class consciousness at the expense of looking at statism itself. So it's hard to know which groups are most likely to be libertarians. We just got to hate the government and hope for a free market where all interests will be harmonized. Thank you very much.